This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Broadcasting from the state-of-the-art L-shaped studios at beautiful and serene Hoho Loon Plaza in Vancouver, British Columbia, Greg Phillips and Nick Duke are the hard-traveling fanboys.
Hard-traveling fanboys. Welcome, everyone, one and all, to another thrilling edition of the Hard Traveling Fanboys. I am Greg Phillips. With me is my hard traveling compatriot, Nick Duke. And we, of course, comprise the longest running
weekly episodic comic book podcast in all of Place to Be Nation.
And that is indeed our catchphrase, which was done quite well, actually, by the girls over at Geek and Sassy a week ago on our 100th edition podcast. We'd like to, is something wrong with your sinuses there, Nick?
No.
Barrett Salee. We would like to thank all of our friends and cohorts who contributed last week to our 100th edition podcast with those very kind words and songs and comedy routines and earnest comments. It was very, very nice. I would also like to thank Jim Varney, who came through the grave to offer us some earnest comments as well. And so we are bringing you a very abbreviated edition of the Longbook Hunters. For those who don't know, the Longbook Hunters is our punny name for our series in which we look at longbooks, graphic novels, trade paperbacks, or other collected editions, and give our thoughts on those editions. Now, this is Love Month here at the Hard Traveling Fanboys, in which we become the Heart Traveling Fanboys to talk all about stuff that we love. And unfortunately, we're not going to have a lot of time to talk about today's topic, which is Scott Snyder and Greg Capullo's Batman Volume 1 and Volume 2, The Court of Owls and The City of Owls. We'll get into that in a minute. There have been some extenuating circumstances in the last week or so, so we're not going to have a very long show for you tonight, which some of you are probably breathing a sigh of relief about right now. We are instead going to try to work at a brisk, quicker than a hiccup pace, quite frankly.
There you go. Yep. Like a the Mexican jumping bean, Eddie Guerrero. We're going to work quickly, so.
That's right. And that sound you just heard was me slurping on a delicious Smoothie King smoothie. Smoothie King, the king of smoothies.
Yes. Greg's going to plug Smoothie King, even though he literally paid them, and they have paid us nothing. So,
no, but thanks for that plug. If you're a listener and you work for the Smoothie King Corporation, we'd love to have you on as a sponsor. We love the product, and we think that our audience would enjoy the product as well.
If you work for any corporation and you would like to, you know, be a sponsor, we pretty much love your product, whatever that product may be.
That's exactly right. If you haven't actually filed to make your corporation legal, we would still love to take on a sponsorship from you.
Yeah.
If you're an underworld organization, hell, we don't really care. We'll still take a sponsorship from you.
If you're the Flat Earth Society, I mean, we'd probably be willing to work something out there as well.
Hey. You pay me enough money, I'll stick a Flat Earth sticker on the side of my car.
Exactly.
As I drive from Vancouver to Alabama every week.
We are very much the Winston Zedmores of Place to Be Nation Pop. As long as there's a steady paycheck involved, we'll believe anything you say.
Exactly. And anything you say can and will be sold to the general public.
That's true. For example, Greg has recently found out the importance of etiquette.
That's a great point. I learned that it's important that you don't eat with the wrong fork or use the wrong kind of napkin when you eat at a fine dining establishment. I also learned that etiquette is one of the single most important tenets in life. Hmm. That if you practice good etiquette, it means you are objectively a better person.
I have nothing. I have nothing to say to that. I think that all stands on its own merit.
Exactly. Now, when I think of merit and I think of etiquette, I think of the hard traveling fanboys.
Obviously.
Certainly. But I also think about the merit worthy tenure of Scott Snyder.
Good Lord.
And Craig Capullo.
Just say nevertheless and we'll move on.
And on the new 52. No, that's good. I never thought about that before. The new 52 yeah. Version of Batman. Now, Capullo was a newcomer to Batman at this time, joining the title at the New 52 relaunch in 2011. Mm-hmm. And as his partner, his creative partner, was writer Scott Snyder, who had started on The Dark Knight writing Detective Comics before the New 52 in the old pre-Flashpoint continuity. He wrote the incredible story, Batman the Black Mirror, that I don't know if we've ever talked about before, perhaps in our columns.
Yeah, I think we had a column on it at one point, but not a yes. Not a podcast.
One of the great modern Batman stories. And he wrote that, had this classic run on there, and that earned him the opportunity to take over Batman number one as they were relaunching it in the wake of Grant Morrison's run, and to kick off a new era for the Caped Crusader and his family. Now, one of the advantages he had being a Batman writer, and because of the success of Batman, is that there was really no need to reboot Batman completely from the ground up. So he was able to just come in and kind of interpret characters how he wanted to interpret them. If he wanted to reimagine a classic villain or a classic side character, he could. Or if he wanted to keep them exactly the same, he was welcome to do that as well. And so enter the court and the knight and the city of Owls, which is a sprawling epic storyline that encompassed his first year on Batman. It took up that entire first year, 12 issues long, and came to be something of a definitive story for modern Batman fans. Would you agree, Nick?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we, let's see, I guess it was last year, did our top five issues of the Scott Snyder run, and I think both of us had a couple of different issues from this run in that top five, you know. He went on to write the character for over 50 issues, over 100 issues if you want to count Batman Eternal and Batman and Robin Eternal, a couple of weekly titles that he also was heavily involved with, and then it is still charting the character's future with the current event series, Metal. And so it's surprising that after all those years of writing the character, from Black Mirror all the way up to today with Metal, that a lot of people still point back all the way back to Court of Owls and Night of Owls as his finest offering. And I would, most days, I would tend to agree with that. Not that what's come since has been bad by any stretch of the imagination, but Court of Owls or Night of Owls is like it's almost like the Clayton Bigsby sketch of, you know, Scott Snyder's Batman tenure, where in his number one issue, his first storyline on the main title, he knocked a freaking home run out of the park that is difficult to surpass.
Yes, completely agreed. It's the Andrew Jones of comic book runs, in that it started out so hot, hitting home runs in the World Series, that even though the rest of the career was very good, it was never quite able to necessarily match that initial burst. And I wouldn't even necessarily agree, because I'm a big fan of Zero Year, and I'm a big fan of Endgame, but this is certainly by any means one of the better opening arcs I can remember for any creative team.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yeah. It's hard to think of one outside of perhaps Jason Aaron and Asad Ribic on Thor: God of Thunder, who came out of the gate swinging to such a degree. But that's something I'm sure we will get into here over the next little bit.
Yeah, and so the The Court of Owls is the first volume, and that comprises the first 7 issues of Snyder and Capullo's run. And then City of Owls is the next 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12.
Yeah, and I think there's an annual that's mostly a flashback to early days of the Court of Owls doing stuff, so that's there as well.
So a lot of this is picking up threads that were talked about in Snyder's Detective Comics run, which featured Dick Grayson as Batman. And in that run, it was intrinsic in all of those mini arcs that he did on Detective that Gotham was a character in and of itself. And he was more, I think, explicit about that than any writer had ever been before him, about how the city itself was a character. And there are lines delivered by Jim Gordon and Dick Grayson throughout that story, The Black Mirror, about how it feels like Gotham is working against them actively, like as a collective, as if there's some spiritual entity in Gotham that has caused it to be the way that it is over time. And we get to see that explored in this New 52 storyline, The Court of Owls. We also pick up threads from the collaboration of Scott Snyder and, who was it? Was it Scott Snyder and Jeff Lemire that collaborated on Gates of Gotham? Or Kyle Higgins. Kyle Higgins that did Gates of Gotham, which was a story set in the pre-Flashpoint universe about the foundation and formation of Gotham. And it was a great story. It was really good and kind of set up the familial relationships in early Gotham between the Wayne family, the Cobblepot family, and the Kane family as sort of the three pillar families of Gotham. And you get to see that picked up on as well in The Court of Owls. And the title itself, Court of Owls, is indicative of Scott Snyder coming in along with Capullo and building from the ground up a brand new A-list Batman villain that has been there the whole time, but is just now coming to the forefront. And it's, as it proved to be, and we said it would be at the time, it was really the first that I can think of lasting new Batman villain that had been created in quite some time, because I don't feel like any of Grant Morrison's villain creations, certainly, you know, his creation of Damian Wayne stuck around and was.
And I think there's an element of endurance for the character of Professor Pig, but that's probably the only one of his that would
Professor
be
Professor Pig. Yeah,
you know,
but he never was an A-list villain. His A-list villain was probably Dr. Hurt, and that didn't really catch on.
The worst.
So, and then you could go back beyond that. I mean, I'm trying to think, Nick, when was the last new lasting A or even B-list Batman villain before The Court of Owls?
I'd say Harley Quinn.
Yeah, and that's going back to the 90s.
Yep.
Hush in 2002.
Good point. Yeah, I was going to say Hush has really only been done well by one creative team, but no, Paul Dini did some good stuff with Hush as well. So, yeah. Hush. We can go with Hush.
So that's still been, you know, at this point, a decade, pretty much. And so Snyder and Capullo are building this brand new villain concept. And it's really not one, I say a new villain, it's really not one villain. It's a villain concept because it's this group, this sort of, and appropriately enough, labyrinthine group that has their elitists, their well-to-dos that trace their lineage back to the founding fathers of Gotham. And they have secretly run the city for hundreds of years since its foundation.
Yeah.
And they spread to bureaucrats. They spread to businessmen. They spread to politicians. They are all over the place, and they meet in secret. And as they have this secret cabal of assassins known as the Talons that do their bidding for them, that are kind of souped up, undead super soldiers that do their bidding for them to make sure that Gotham remains exactly in the hands of who it's supposed to be in, that the wrong people don't ask the wrong questions, things of that nature. And the way that Snyder and Capullo tie this into what we already know about Batman and his history is really quite clever, I think. Because it's certainly, I think this would qualify as a retcon, Nick, personally, because it's introducing information that is said to have been there the whole time that was never there,
right,
such as Bruce's childhood nursery rhyme, the same way that we said that Hush retconned the existence of Tommy Elliot.
Right.
This was very much a retcon, but it's another example of a retcon that works.
Yeah, I would agree. You know, when you have it explained to you without any real contextual knowledge, just saying, hey, it's this mysterious group that's just so happened to have been in Gotham the entire time Batman's been out there operating, you know, on its face, it sounds like a silly premise, and it sounds like something that probably shouldn't work nearly as well as it does. And instead,
right,
the execution of it is nearly perfect, because you kind of hate those, you know, those kinds of stories a lot of times in superhero comics where it's like, well, actually, these people just were here the entire time, you know, biding their time or whatever. And that's, mm-hmm, you know, a lot of writers can't pull that off, but to Snyder's credit, he makes it believable in a way that most of the people couldn't, you know. It's always nice to see, as much as I love Bat God, you know, when Bruce is portrayed as all-knowing and borderline all-powerful, it is nice to see Gotham genuinely throw him for a loop from time to time, and that is certainly what happens over the course of these 12 issues.
Right, and it all centers on that original premise of the Black Mirror, that Gotham is a character, that Gotham is a almost a being unto itself, like almost like Mel Kiper Jr.'s hair, an entity unto itself that lives, that breathes, that grows, that cannot be tamed by any known hairspray, that just permeates throughout everyone that lives there, everyone that works there, everyone that even visits there. And Snyder uses this to play into Bruce's psyche, because Bruce thinks that Gotham is his city. Think of how many Batman stories that we've seen since the Frank Miller days where Bruce refers to Gotham as my city. It's my city. Even in his inner monologue, it's my city. Well, here, Snyder flips that whole thing on its face and says, no, Bruce, not only is it not your city, you don't even know the city. You have no idea what the city is. And that's kind of what this explores, is what is Gotham City really? And does Bruce really have all the answers? And as it turns out, no, he doesn't. And like you said, it kind of flies in the face of what we had gotten, and kind of setting the template for what Snyder and Capullo's run would be. It flew in the face of what we had gotten for 10 to 15 to even 20 years prior, which is the Bat God, the Batman who is always prepared for every situation, who can easily overcome any opponent that gets in his way, and who is six steps ahead of everyone around him. Well, here it's saying, how is Bruce going to react when it turns out that it was all based on a lie, the lie being that this is his city and criminals are a cowardly and superstitious lot? Problem is, he didn't know who the criminals were. They were playing him the whole time. So it's a really interesting examination of how somebody with the indomitable will of Bruce Wayne deals with his ego being put in check by some aspects, some villains, some people that managed to elude even his awareness since he was a kid. And they tied into his past, Nick, with that great flashback of Bruce as a child hearing that Court of Owls nursery rhyme and chasing it down because he believes it's real. He believes it's real, and then he finds that it's not real, that it's a fake nursery rhyme. And so he instantly wipes it out and forgets about it for the rest of his life and just dismisses the possibility that it could even be real. Which is funny for a guy that dresses up like a bat.
yeah, it's you summed it up pretty well, I would say. Like I mentioned earlier, it definitely flies in the face of Bat God, but it's always unique to see Bruce put in a position where he really doesn't know what to make of something, where he really just does not you know, it's always great to have Gotham reveal new things to him and show him threats that he didn't even know he was capable of dealing with. So it definitely, like you said, plays into that idea of Gotham as a character and how it can kind of show you, reveal to you things that you don't expect, and it kind of shows you whatever is going to try you in the most challenging way at all times. So Snyder, more so than any writer in recent memory anyway, has always been the best about making Gotham a character unto itself, and this story is a prime example of that.
Absolutely. And right from the get-go, Snyder throws us right into the action with a really weird and fun action scene where Bruce is battling a bunch of Arkham inmates that are consisting of a lot of his older villains. Two-Face is there, Professor Pig is there, Clayface, just a litany of villains. Your favorite, the Flamingo, El Flamingo. They're all there, and he battles them all, and he's beaten up by them at one point, and he's helped out by what appears to be the Joker, but is in fact Dick Grayson in disguise as the Joker. And it's a great little misdirection there. We get to see, and this is something you don't see a lot of in Snyder and Capullo's run, but we do see the Bat family in this very first issue. You see Bruce, Dick, Tim, and Damian all together at this Wayne function, and instantly it almost makes me sad to think about the fact that we didn't get Snyder writing more of them as a unit.
Yeah.
Because so much of his run was focused on Bruce.
Well, to be fair, you know, Batman Eternal kind of was that. You know, Batman Eternal was more of a team book. It was about the entire pantheon of Bat family characters, which is why I think I enjoyed it a lot more than most people did, because it's always been something that I've wanted, and it's one of the reasons I'm loving this current James Tynion Detective Comics run so much, because it feels like an actual Bat family book as opposed to just the Batman book, which is something I think is not... it is not done enough of these days. But like you said, Snyder in those first couple issues does a great job and really has a key role for Dick Grayson in a Batman story, which is unusual because most people treat Dick like an afterthought these days.
Yes. And I've always, there's one thing I've always said since I was a teenager at least and hit puberty, you should never treat Dick as an afterthought. It's never a good thing to do that. But I will say that Snyder, and this is where some people take issue with me, because I am sometimes hypercritical of Nightwing books, even though Nightwing's my favorite character. And I think part of it is, controversially perhaps, I feel like Scott Snyder writes the best Dick Grayson maybe of anyone that I've read. In that I feel like his version or his reading of the Dick and Bruce relationship is and was the same as mine. And the way that he writes Dick's inner monologue and his dialogue, both with Bruce and with enemies, is spot on and perfect. And really, I wish, you know, one of my dream projects in comics is Scott Snyder writing a Nightwing ongoing, which probably isn't going to happen, but I think that would be awesome. But I say that to tie it back into this book, which is our topic of conversation, in that he writes an incredible Nightwing, incredible Dick Grayson, but an incredible Damian, a great Tim. All of the supporting characters are written really well here, and perhaps none better than Alfred, which is true of the entire Snyder and Capullo run. But Alfred always has to be there to provide the sarcastic British quip, but he's that here, and he's also so much more. And I know that was an aspect of the entire run that really appealed to you, Nick.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sorry I missed your prompt, Greg. it's been a hell of a week. Will you set me up one more time?
Yes, I was just talking about the relationship between Bruce Wayne and Alfred.
The story here
and the entire run.
Yeah, not just, like you were saying, not just that story, but this entire run, even continuing into Scott Snyder's work on All-Star Batman, which was a little underwhelming given the hype level coming into it, but Alfred played a very key role throughout that series. And that's one thing, you know, Batman kind of has two different I guess you could call them familial type relationships with a couple of older men, and I've always loved both, and that's Alfred Pennyworth, of course, and James Gordon. And, you know, Snyder, throughout his entire run, even in he showed it here with this story to begin with, he nailed both of those relationships and just showed a level of mastery for Batman supporting cast that, you know, few writers ever approach, not just for Batman, but for any comic character. Snyder was at the peak of his powers here, and that shines through in his writing of Alfred and, to a lesser extent, Commissioner Gordon.
It just goes to prove that old, age-old saying that I think goes back to the dawn of comics, actually, in the Siegel and Shuster days, and that saying is that older men are beautiful fathers.
Are beautiful fathers. Older men, they understand.
Exactly. And
is that two Bellamy Brothers references in 2 weeks?
Yes, it is, in fact. If I said that we made two Bellamy Brothers references in 2 weeks, would you hold it against me?
Would I hold it against you? I would not. True.
That's very good. So, Court of Owls involves all of these Bat family members, but a lot of them kind of get out of the way in the early going. You know, it's very much Snyder, more so than any other Bat writer of his era, focuses on Bruce Wayne as much as Batman, if not more. I think that Snyder has Batman out of the costume, maybe more than most of his contemporaries, and is very much interested in restoring both the duality of Bruce Wayne and Batman and exploring the concept of, now that he has this freedom with the New 52, going with a Batman who is maybe not in lockstep with the traditionally accepted Batman is the real identity and Bruce Wayne is the shell, but he goes with an approach of, there is Batman, there is Bruce Wayne, and then there's the real Bruce Wayne. And the real Bruce Wayne is what he wants to get to. And I thought that was an interesting approach, Nick, to a character that, you know, has, for most of our lives, been into that, you know, Batman is the real person and right. Bruce Wayne is just the mask.
Right.
So this was kind of an interesting approach.
Yeah, I agree. It's a more... To me, it's a more relatable approach. I mean, not that you need Batman to be the peak of relatability or anything, but there's a reason why so many people gravitate towards the character and towards the concept. It's because, you know, we find something in the idea that trauma can scar us and we can use it as a motivator to be something better. But at the same time, you know, Bruce Wayne didn't just cease to exist in that alley. I know some people like to think that, but that's never been my reading of the situation. And specifically... that child that he was still comes out at times when he's around Alfred because it's the only thing he has to call him back to his parents. So, yeah, another aspect of this series that Snyder just was right on the money with.
Yeah, and it also speaks to the malleability of Batman. And I think it was either Frank Miller or Grant Morrison that said this about Batman, that he can be... more so than any other character, almost. He can be bent, he can be twisted, he can be molded, but he can never break. That he has a certain core. He can be different things for different people as long as he's who he is at his core. And that's true of Batman almost beyond any other character, and we've seen it. And I think this is another example of just finding a new wrinkle to explore. And they do a good job of it. He and Capullo... tell this story in a very compelling fashion, which we'll get into in just a moment. But before that, we talked a little bit about the Court of Owls, and what's interesting here is I think the trend has been for most people that take over Batman to want to get to the heavy hitter villains right away. Mm-hmm. They want to do their Joker story, they want to do their Two-Face story, you know, their Penguin story or whatever it may be. Snyder pretty much eschews all of that. And pretty much skips right over with the exception of that beginning of that first issue, skips over all the iconic villains to get right to his original creation here, the Court of Owls. What did you make of that, Nick, the decision to do that? And was it, looking back on it, is it surprising that they chose that route, Snyder Capullo, or is that something that you think was the right thing to do to then set them up for later, being able to go back and tell stories about the Joker and the Riddler? and so on.
Right. Well, the important thing is that it's not, I mean, yes, it's a number one, and yes, it's part of this New 52, but, you know, Batman was one of the few characters whose continuity, with the exception of the ridiculous 5-year timeline they were trying to fit everything into, they didn't really make efforts to erase a lot of his continuity. And so, like you mentioned earlier, you know, this was playing off a lot of things that Snyder had been setting up in Black Mirror. And so it's kind of natural that he had to continue to tell that story. You know, you didn't want to take a long break, you know, from it, out of fear that you could lose momentum. Readers could forget the details. And so it was kind of important they went ahead and came out of the gates with this one. But they did it in a smart way because, like you mentioned, that opening issue, it's like, hey, here are all these villains you know and recognize. And it's kind of telling you, like, in those opening pages, here's who each villain is, here's the threat they represent, here's what they, you know, reflect about Gotham, and it kind of sets up that narrative of, now here's this other, you know, unseen threat that shows a side of Gotham we didn't even know existed. And so, you know, it was definitely a risky move, but it was one that obviously paid off.
And as the story builds, we see the Court of Owls conspiracy start to unfold and Bruce start to figure it out that there is this giant conspiracy that dates back to, you know, his grandfather and great-grandfather's generations. And along the way, we see something that we're very unaccustomed to seeing outside of Scarecrow stories, which is a Batman who is genuinely afraid. Mm-hmm. We see that fear, and that is largely through the strength of Greg Capullo, who creates this eerie, superstitious horror vibe around the concept of the Court of Owls and really expresses the looming terror in Bruce's eyes as this whole thing unfolds and he starts to find out more and more secrets. Of course, there are many, many great standout moments along the way, but we also see the talons that arise and create some pretty cool action sequences, but I think that is to the credit of Greg Capullo, because we've talked so much about Scott Snyder so far, but his partner all along the way in developing all this and telling the story is Greg Capullo. So let's talk about him for a minute. Capullo was a name in comics back in the 90s who had done runs on a few various Marvel titles, such as X-Force was probably his most famous one that he drew for some time. And then he really grew to prominence while doing Spawn for Image. But this was very much, for a lot of us, sort of an introduction to Greg Capullo. For those of us who maybe, I read a lot of his comics when I was a kid, but I didn't know his name. Like, I never recognized his name. But for a lot of us, this was an introduction to his style and to what he does. And he hits the ground running with some of the most dynamic action scenes that you'll find in comics, but also with his ability to, I think, tap into the sort of warped and twisted mind of Scott Snyder and get across these out there concepts that they were creating together. And part of that comes down to the design of the Court of Owls. Because I truly believe, Nick, that one of the keys to a lasting villain is they have to have a great design, mm-hmm. especially in the modern era. You have to have a great design, and those freaking owl masks, like the Talon design is good, but the really iconic great design was those freaking owl masks.
Yep.
For the Court of Owls.
Absolutely agreed. And you know, it's one of those things, when you see one on the page, it has one effect, but when you see them all standing there together, it has this very, very different effect. It's one of the more, you know, and it kind of makes sense now, looking back on it, why Capullo was chosen, because as a writer of Spawn and stuff, he was obviously well-versed in comics that leaned into the horror aspect of things. And while Batman doesn't, or hasn't, up until recently anyway, gotten into the demonic and the, you know, the out-there side of it that Spawn would, there are definitely a little bit of an unsettling horror-like quality to some of the pages here, and he brings that over extremely well. I know when they finally released this as a trade and they had the box set with the owl mask in there, those things flew off the shelves because people were so enamored with that design.
Yeah, and it's something that would be great for Halloween, for sure, for costume parties and so forth. And it's become iconic. It's really helped them catch on the way that the Harley Quinn design helped her catch on back in the 90s. Now, you know, so we've talked a little bit about that. We've been pretty effusive in our praise of this so far. So let's talk about some of the key standout moments along the way. I think for me, I think of the issue sort of a little bit past the halfway point where we learn that Dick Grayson was actually supposed to be one of the Talons, mm-hmm. as Bruce actually which is one of the scenes that I know some people don't like, and I've gone back and forth on it over the years too, where Bruce knocks out a tooth of Dick's that has the tracking device in it or what have you, the marker of the Court of Owls, and but it was just a very tense scene, and I go back and forth, but I find myself coming down on the side of really liking it because of what it set up. It made Dick Grayson seem essential to the story,
right.
Which is, as you know, my biggest pet peeve with Nightwing's involvement in Batman stories is he never feels like he's essential to anything. He feels like he's there to almost be a damsel in distress for Bruce Wayne to save.
Yeah.
So this made it feel like Dick was actually, made it seem like Dick was important, Nick.
Yeah, I agree. That's a great moment. The issue, I believe it's 5, that takes place in the Court of Owls underground labyrinth where they have essentially got Batman there and trying to slowly drive him insane, because it features that now iconic moment that a lot of people thought was a printing error where the page actually, you know, to signify confusion and disorientation, Capullo and Snyder actually had the page printed upside down. Which is just a brilliant piece of visual storytelling. So you've got that, the moments like that. Of course, near the end of the book, you have, I don't want to spoil what the implied reveal is, but it's a pretty big time reveal that if the villain is telling the truth, kind of rewrites Batman's entire familial history.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I have to ask, that's kind of, if there is something controversial about this story, that would probably be it. And the beauty of it is it's never fully answered. And so I can choose not to believe the reveal, which is what I chose to do, and to believe that it was more mind games. What about you, Nick? How did you approach that, and what are your thoughts on it?
No, I kind of like to actually view it that he's telling the truth. And the reason why is because there is a tendency, I think, at times for writers to write the Waynes as if they were saints, as if they were infallible. And I think it's important to acknowledge they were good people, but they were people. They were human beings. They were flawed. And I think the existence of this character and the backstory that he alleges helps to illustrate that fact, that they were not without fault in some areas, and they were not, you know, they were far from perfect, I think is the way
I would put it. Do you think that swings the pendulum too far, though?
No, I don't.
Because I have noticed that's kind of the new trend, is kind of to go the opposite way with that. We saw it on the Telltale game,
mm-hmm.
where the Waynes are certainly portrayed in the internet. Now, that came way after Court of Owls, obviously.
Right.
But, I don't know.
I don't think it swings it too wildly, because I think they try to get across the idea that, you know, and I don't want to get too deep into it, because, like, I mean, I know it's an old story, but for those who haven't read it, like, for perhaps Brad hasn't read it yet, he might, you know, want to dig into it on the comics thread. But
he might, and if you spoil it, he might then mention that in the award-winning Place to Be Nation comics Facebook page.
There you
award-winning,
go.
Award-winning. I just spoiled the halfies. So,
but no, I think it it doesn't swing the pendulum too far that way for me, because I get the impression that the Waynes took an action that they felt was compassionate and they felt was right, even though it really wasn't. You know, I don't view it as malicious intent, I guess is the way I would
right.
put it.
And that's the beauty of this, because you can choose to believe that, and mm-hmm. and if you want, and I read it and chose not to believe it, and I don't think it really hurts my reading of it in any way. Mm-hmm. And that's a really good ambiguous ending, and also the fact that it toys with Bruce's belief structure and toys with his feelings going forward and shakes him to his foundation. And then, of course, Nick, you know what my favorite moment in the Court of Owls and City of Owls is, It's the moment when it's all over at the very end. And it's a scene between Bruce Wayne and Dick Grayson that is actually my all-time favorite scene between Bruce Wayne and Dick Grayson. I don't want to spoil it for those who have never read the story, but they're in Wayne Manor, and it's this touching heart-to-heart where Bruce says probably the most heartwarming thing that I can ever remember him saying to Nightwing in the whole time that they've known each other. And so it's an all-time favorite comic book memory for me. It's probably my favorite individual scene that Snyder has written because it involves my favorite character. So just a great story. Both of these collections should be bought. Or I think they may have collected them together by this point. But if they haven't, get both of these collections, both of these hardcovers if you can, because they're both extremely worth it, in my opinion. This is one of the best modern Batman stories, for my money.
I agree wholeheartedly. Can't say it any better than that. I think it's still probably my favorite, especially if you view Court of Owls and City of Owls as one story like I do. I think it's still Snyder's best Batman story, and that's saying something because he's written several at this point that are legitimate all-time mm-hmm. classics.
Yeah, and Capullo was really just coming into his own here, and he would probably hit higher heights later in the run with some of his incredible work on Endgame and things like that. Mm-hmm. But that Labyrinth issue is one of the most innovative things I've ever seen in superhero comics. And just his ability to make the city come alive in a way that the great Batman artists can, he certainly has earned his place among the great Batman artists.
Absolutely. No doubt about that.
So with all that being said, folks, do you have opinions about the Court of Owls, the City of Owls, the Night of Owls? Let us know. Tweet us at gphillips8652, at nickduke87. Go to the Facebook Place to Be Nation Comics page. Just go to Facebook, type in Place to Be Nation Comics in the search bar. We'll come up, join the group, join the discussion. We have a lot of great threads going on there right now. You, of course, can email us, gregp@placetobenation.com, nickd@placetobenation.com, the two loneliest email addresses on the internet. And, of course, you can also tweet us at JRsBBQ if you would also like to send any complaints our way. That's the place to send the complaints, at JRsBBQ. Well, if you stick with us through the break, we'll be back on the other end with the rundown. We're not going to do reading and watching this week. Nick hasn't had time to watch any of the shows. Neither of us have had time to read anything this past week, so... stay with us through the break, and we will hit you with the biggest news and notes in the comic book world, The Rundown.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlayStation.com, and we offer those to you on three great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the original Place to Be podcast, as well as Main Event, Lucha Afterground, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows, as well as the Our Vantage Point podcast and Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver quick-hit pod blasts on topics old and new.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Psychology is Dead, Puro Puri, Stacy and Elliot's Bogus Journey, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Letters from Center Stage, Space City, an NWA Classics On Demand adventure, Through the Years, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Kayfabe, and much more. And on our popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, PTBN Dadcast, Go Home in a Box, NBA Team, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, Geek and Sassy, and Imaginary Stories podcasts.
You can find all of these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including the Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to all of our feeds on iTunes, and while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when shopping online, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Hey, Nick, I've got a great idea for what we can do now that we're back from the break.
What's that?
Well, we're here in the L-shaped studio, so what better time than to let's chase each other around the L-shaped room tonight.
Well, you know, one thing I learned this past week, Greg, is when it comes to chasing each other around the L-shaped room, when you're hot, you're hot.
You hot. Oh, my. Oh, my. Somebody get that bird for me.
Eastbound and down, loaded up and trucking.
That's right. And you know, Nick, I've always known this about you. You are a guitar man.
That's true. That's true. My favorite, if we're making Jerry Reed references, is of course the legend of Amos Newsom.
That is our hard traveling challenge to the listening audience. Go to YouTube and find the ballad of Amos Newsom. Find it and watch it.
And if you're not from the Dothan, Alabama area, you should probably Google Amos Newsom. Ken Curtis video before you go listen to the song.
Amos Newsom Ken Curtis video.
Yes.
And watch as he uses tiger claw kung fu to attack a local newsman. And then go watch the ballad of Amos Newsom, and which is especially great if you're familiar with
there's actually a lot of prerequisites you have to do here. So after you Google Ken Curtis Amos Newsom video, then go Google the ballad of Amos Moses, and then go Google the ballad of Amos Newsom.
Ballad of Amos Newsom. Oh,
it's a very layered reference that we're making here, and none of you are going to care enough to do any of this, so it's all good.
Indeed. But if you get me in a room at any point, at maybe one of our many hard traveling fanboys conventions
yeah,
that we have around the country.
At airports.
Pulling me aside at airport. If you see me at the airport, pull me aside and ask me to tell you about my time covering the Dothan City Commission and one commissioner, Amos Newsom. Mm-hmm. I've got some stories for you. But all that is meaningless in the grand scheme of things. So let's talk about some things that are also meaningless in the grand scheme of things, but which matter to us because we're giant nerds. And that is, of course, our weekly look at the news and notes in the comic book world, our weekly segment called The Rundown.
Welcome to The Rundown.
When you're hot, you're hot.
Where we talk some comic news.
When you're not, you're not.
And this rundown starts with what everybody is talking about at the airports, Nick. As you know, they pull me aside at the airports to ask me about the show all the time. And this week, they're asking me this. They're asking me, they ask Greg, what do you got to say about this Infinity War trailer? And I say to him, Vin, I don't want to talk to you about the Infinity War trailer. I want to wait for the show. And they're getting on my case about it. They say, hey, what's Nick think about it? I say, I don't know. You have to ask him. So the point is, Nick, it's time. We got to let folks know what we think about this brand new trailer for Avengers Infinity War, the release of which said movie is just around the corner here in just, about a month now?
A month, yeah.
So, Nick, your thoughts on the trailer, and then I'll give you mine.
It's fucking awesome. I mean, I don't know what else to say about it, really. It's like, it's one of those things where I'm getting to a point where I want to stop seeing so much stuff now because everything they release just continues to raise my hype level even higher. And I don't want this movie to be burdened by unrealistic expectations. This trailer. Loved everything you see in it, from the moment with Thanos threatening to murder Captain America, essentially, as his massive hand closes in over Cap's head, to the interactions between Star-Lord and Tony Stark, and between Spider-Man and Doctor Strange. Just great, great stuff. Going to clearly have that trademark Marvel sense of humor. The action looks incredible. You know, all things considered, I am just beyond pumped for this movie and cannot wait for April 27th to roll around.
Couldn't agree more. Honestly, this is a movie kind of like Star Wars where I don't need trailers for it. I'm going to go see it regardless. So trailers really ultimately don't matter that much to me. I'm going to go see it regardless. But in this case, this trailer was amazing.
Yes.
The Spider-Man and Doctor Strange line at the end was terrific. Seeing Star-Lord and Tony Stark meet for the first time was somehow better than I imagined it would be. In their interaction in the trailer, just seeing the visual, seeing how the teams are going to pair off, it seems, it looks so awesome. And like I was telling somebody, actually my boss and I at work today were talking about this. I said, at worst case scenario, this is going to be one of the greatest fan service movies of all time. That's worst case. At worst, we're going to get a lot of great fan service. And that's even if the movie around it isn't very good. Best case, I don't even want to talk about.
Yeah. Yeah, the hype level, the hype train rolls on as we, you know, as Monday Night Raw moves on or whatever the fuck it is that Cole says these days.
Apparently, Michael Cole says that things are obnoxious before they air.
I haven't gotten there yet, but I'm looking forward to hearing what all that fuss was about here in the next few hours, hopefully.
I don't believe they were necessarily his thoughts, and I'll leave it at that.
This is talk best reserved for the wrestling minute.
That's true. So, with that being said, DC is getting ready to finally, it seems, put their own cosmic film out there, and that is going to come from a rather unexpected direction, as director Ava DuVernay, who of course is known for Academy Award winning films, and also her recent movie A Wrinkle in Time, her first really big budget fantasy movie. She is going to be directing a film based on Jack Kirby's New Gods.
Yes.
That will reportedly connect to the DC Extended Universe films.
Oh God, does that mean she's locked into that terrible version of Steppenwolf?
I would certainly hope not.
Because that would suck.
So, DuVernay had met with Marvel Studios about directing Black Panther, but she ultimately turned it down. She has talked openly about being a huge New Gods fan, mm-hmm. and in particular, she's a huge fan of Big Barda.
Right.
Who, of course, is the wife of Mr. Miracle.
Right.
So you'd have to assume that those two would form a linchpin of this movie if it does indeed come to fruition.
Yeah, that's all well and good, but I think we both know there is only one thing that this movie needs to be a guaranteed success.
And that, of course, is Ed As Lesnar as Granny Goodness.
It is. Now, if I may, I had this thought whenever this news was announced that, you know, Ava DuVernay, and rightfully so, has earned a reputation with a Wrinkle of Time of looking for opportunities to insert diversity wherever possible. And that's certainly a good thing to reach out for. And so I am of the opinion that if they decide not to go with Ed Asner being a white man, they want to recast the role as an African American, Greg, I think there's an opportunity for some degrees of Vel Johnson to be inserted here into the Granny Goodness role.
Ooh. Now that is interesting. You're suggesting that Carl could be Granny Goodness?
I think Carl Winslow would be an excellent black Granny Goodness.
Harriet.
The voice, I mean, think about it.
Yes, I can see it. For Dark Side.
And the great thing is, he would keep the mustache.
Yes, yes, yes. This is all very good. We can only hope that Granny Goodness is included in Ava's new guy.
Well, it has
movie.
To be. If you're doing, I mean, like, all jokes aside, she said on Twitter that her favorite character was Big Barda. And if you're going to do Barda, you would probably want
to do the Furies.
You have to do the Furies. And if you're doing the Furies, you have to do Granny Goodness, right? I mean, like,
right.
And part of the whole deal of doing New Gods, if you're going to do it, is you got to lean into some of those weird out there concepts. And so I would be stunned if, honestly, if Granny Goodness was not a part of this movie in some way, shape, form, or fashion, probably in a significant role.
Yes. And they're getting a lot of due praise for their hire of Ava DuVernay, who is a black woman, which will add to diversity in their hiring practices, and who has made some great films already. I'm really excited. I think I'm temperately excited, because I'm not entirely convinced it's going to happen like you. We've talked about this. We as DC fans don't get to have good things on the big screen very often. So, but I will say she's a good choice to helm the project. I know Wrinkle in Time is getting kind of mixed reviews, but at the same time, she has an Academy Award under her belt. That was her first chance with a huge budget to do a movie like that. And so I think she's going to learn from that experience. And on top of that, the New Gods are such a weird out there concept that can be divorced from what we've seen so far on the big screen and do their own thing. I say go for it. You know, like, this is something that is a weird, different concept that could very well work, and could also be a way to, here's a crazy idea. I don't know if you've ever considered this, Nick. I don't know, actually. Use Darkseid instead of one of his freaking minions.
You know, that doesn't bother me as much as it bothers you, I think, just because I want to see Darkseid, I want to see a version of Darkseid that feels, I don't know, earned, I guess. And I didn't really want to see him in the first Justice League movie, because I wanted him to be the threat that, you know, had to be built to.
Yes,
but here in a New Gods movie, has to be there.
Steppenwolf?
No, I did not want to see Steppenwolf either. But, you know, you do. What can you do?
Steppenwolf is part of an ensemble of villains, I can see.
Right.
But, you know, it's just, this is a project that could right some of the wrongs that have gone on along the way. And
at the very least, let's just hope that the CGI for these New Gods is better than the CGI for Steppenwolf.
Oh my God, yes. I hope that they're not CGI'd that much.
No, they don't. It does not need to be a motion capture film, in my opinion.
No.
Except for maybe Darkseid. I really don't know how you can.
Right, right.
You know,
and if you're going to do it well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah. Contact the Lord of the Rings people, whatever. But another gentleman who is trying to right some wrongs is one of the great actors of this or any other generation, and that is the great Nicolas Cage. As many know, he was supposed to play Superman in the late 90s in a Tim Burton-directed Superman film that just never came to fruition. And after all these years, he's finally going to get to play the Man of Steel, Nick. The man who named his child Kal-El can finally play Superman on the big screen, no less, in the Teen Titans Go movie, known as Teen Titans Go to the Movies, according to USA Today.
Yeah, Nick Cage finally getting to play Kal-El. He's a massive fan. Named his kid, I think, after Superman. His Kryptonian name, Kal-El, actually. So, yeah, interesting that he's finally getting this opportunity all these years later. It reminds me kind of what was the other similar role that we that this happened with?
Billy Dee Williams as
Billy Dee Williams
Two-Face,
getting to do the voice of Two-Face in Lego Batman last year. So yeah, cool nod. It's going to be a bit cameo role, so why not do it? So I'm not going to see this movie because I think Teen Titans Go is an abomination that should be wiped off the face of the planet. But you know, it did give us the Wonder Woman hippo, so we can't be too angry at it, I suppose.
Indeed, and let's hope that people are hungry for this movie when it comes out.
Oh, God.
For all of those involved.
Oh.
Now, let's move on to TV and our CW TV universe, and let's go to what we have called the most consistent show in the entire DC CW lineup, and that is Legends of Tomorrow, which has been on quite the roll this season, delivering great episode after great episode. And if the show gets renewed for a fourth season, that's not official yet, but if the show gets renewed for a fourth season, they have already announced that they are adding Matt Ryan as Constantine as a series regular for next year. This is a very exciting announcement for fans of that character, fans of Ryan's portrayal of that character. No, not the football player, the guy that played him on the Constantine TV series. He has already guest shotted on a couple of episodes this season on the show. He fit in great with the cast. They want to add him to the Wave Rider next season, and I, for one, believe that this is a great move on the part of the producers of Legends of Tomorrow.
Yes, absolutely. Legends, even though the cast of the past two seasons has largely remained the same, you know, ideally it should be something of a limited revolving door, where I think you want to have the same four or five core members to build around. You want Ray, you want Mick, you want Sarah. And outside of that, I think you can play with the cast a little bit, and I can't think of a better addition than this version of Constantine. Great move on the part of these guys, and it should just further the decision in the minds of the execs over at the CW to go ahead and let's get this renewal out of the way and move forward on season four.
Indeed. And the character of Constantine kind of gained popularity in Vertigo Comics and the mature imprint of DC back in the 90s, 80s and 90s. And speaking of mature comics, we may be able to see some more of those soon, because DC is launching a new imprint with high-profile creators doing original out-of-continuity stories with the biggest characters in DC. This is going to be known as DC Black Label, and it's going to be consisting of a variety of projects, but right out of the gates, we are getting the following lineup: Superman Year One by Frank Miller and John Romita Jr. We are getting Batman Last Night on Earth by Scott Snyder and Greg Capullo, who we just talked about.
Mm-hmm.
We're getting Batman Damned by Brian Azzarello and Lee Bermejo. We're getting Wonder Woman Historia, The Amazons by Kelly Sue DeConnick and Phil Jimenez. We're getting Wonder Woman Diana's Daughter by Greg Rucka and that famous artist To Be Announced. And we are getting The Other History of the DC Universe by John Ridley and To Be Announced. These projects are all going to be part of this Black Label imprint. So which of these stand out to you? Which ones are you looking forward to,
man? All of them that aren't Superman Year One. Like, I have so little interest in that, in Frank Miller writing a Superman origin. Just not something I'm thrilled about, and I don't know. Just I want to stay as far away from that as I possibly can, but the rest of these sound great. They all either have fantastic concepts or fantastic creative teams, and in some cases, both. I mean, the idea of Snyder and Capullo doing a standalone Batman original graphic novel that's going to be adult-themed? Hell yes. I'm gonna read
with
that.
With the Joker's head in the jar.
Yes. Azzarello and Bermejo getting back together. Absolutely going to read that. Kelly Sue DeConnick and Phil Jimenez doing a history of the Amazons. That sounds amazing. Greg Rucka doing more Wonder Woman stories. I'm always there for that. But the one I think that kind of really just sounds like it has the potential to be different in all the best ways is that other history of the DC Universe written by John Ridley, who wrote 12 Years a Slave. You know, very, you know, a guy who's a very accomplished writer of the minority experience. So this is going to be very interesting to kind of write about the minority experience through the lens of the DC Universe. I think that's a really cool idea. Got to wait and see who the artist is before I you know, shoot it to the top of this list officially for me. But that's the one I look at and go, I don't know that I've ever heard a concept like that before.
Yeah, and I totally agree with you. And another aspect that I should have used to transition into it is that Constantine's actually going to be in the Azzarello Batman mm-hmm. story.
In Batman Damned.
So that's going to be a tie there. But another tie, Black Label, Scott Snyder's one of the key creators associated with this imprint. He is also still doing work in the mainstream DC universe because we finally got the official word that Justice League is relaunching with Scott Snyder at the helm behind the writer's chair and artists Jim Chung and Jorge Jimenez of Super Sons fame working with him to launch a brand new Justice League series spinning out of the weekly No Justice event. It'll be shipped bi-weekly. Justice League number one will be drawn by Chung. Number two will have interiors by Jimenez. They haven't announced how they're going to be splitting those duties. This is a pretty big announcement. And the other big announcement out of this is that the team is essentially the same lineup from the iconic Justice League cartoon series. You've got Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, The Flash, Aquaman, Martian Manhunter, Hawkgirl, Green Lantern, John Stewart, and Cyborg is the only outlier that wasn't on the cartoon. So, pretty
well.
Well,
and Aquaman played a limited role for the most part on the cartoon, but
true, he wasn't a full time member.
With the exception of those two, it's pretty much the team, which is just so cool to see, and something that DC probably should have been doing for a while now.
Right. I think it's a great mix. Of course, I love the iconic Big Seven team mm-hmm. that we saw at the beginning of the New 52. I think that's a great team too. But I think this has been something that we have been overdue to see for a while. I love the idea of John Stewart being in this team role. I think it makes sense, almost to a degree more sense than it makes for Hal to be part of the team. Just a big fan. Of course, I wonder what that means for his role as the leader of the Green Lanterns moving forward, which we'll get into in a moment.
Yep.
But yeah, I'm very excited about this. Snyder writing the Justice League, it just seems like it's going to be great, especially if you remember that he did write them briefly in Endgame, and I'm sure he's writing them now in Metal, which I haven't been reading. But I'm really excited about this.
Yeah, I am as well. It's finally going to be, or should be anyway, something of a return to form for Justice League, which is a title that's kind of been floundering ever since the Rebirth. One of the rare misfires of the Rebirth era has been Justice League, and looking forward to DC, you know, doing their best to get this book back on track, because it really should be, you know, it should be the flagship, and it should be the one-stop shop for, you know, what is driving the continuity of DC for anybody who just wants to check in casually. And it's time for it to get back to being must-read material.
Mm-hmm. Which I am interested in reading the Christopher Priest run, but it seems like a very short run. So,
mm-hmm.
But speaking of returns, we got another big return coming, and that is the return of Hawkman. Yes, Hawkman. He is getting his own series that will spin out of Dark Knight's Metal, which apparently retconned Hawkman's origins and placed in the DC Universe. Stop me if you've heard that before. Hawkman number one will launch in June, and it will be written by Robert Venditti and drawn by Brian Hitch. Now, that's a hell of a creative team right there, Nick.
Yes, it is. Brian Hitch finally going back to art duties as opposed to attempting to write, which is best for all parties involved, I would say. But while I'm excited about seeing Venditti get to take on another high-profile project, it's not without some drawbacks, as I'm sure Greg is going to inform you right now.
Yes. The announcement was also made by Venditti that as a result of this, he is off of Green Lantern. And I believe, Nick, you're going to have to correct me on this because I'm not sure the issue number. I wanted to say issue number 50, but that doesn't sound right.
I believe it's 48, but I don't know that for a fact.
So Robert Venditti, who has been writing Green Lantern really since
Hal Jordan,
2013.
Yeah, because he took over the main Green Lantern title before the Rebirth relaunch when Jeff
right
Johns
after
left.
Jeff Johns left. Yeah.
And let's be honest, most of his pre-Rebirth stuff was terrible.
He
had the occasional bright moment where it was okay, but it was like, you know, for the longest time, Greg, it just seemed like he was a guy who didn't really know how to write Hal Jordan. And it wasn't like he just gradually got better. He went from being really bad to all of a sudden, I don't know if it was just the concept of being able to write a true, you know, Green Lantern team-up book with the main Earth Lanterns as the main cast. But when Rebirth rolled around and they launched Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps to kind of take the place of Green Lantern Corps, he just found his footing and hit his stride in a big, bad way and has been churning out, like we said, it's going to be 48 issues of just outstanding Green Lantern storytelling in the Rebirth era.
Right, and to see that come to an end is sad and very unfortunate, even as far behind as I am on it. I've enjoyed every issue that I've read, and I think it's really sad to see it come to an end. And for a Green Lantern fan, there's a natural trepidation and fear. You know, the trepidation and fear that we had when Jeff Johns announced he was departing is the same. Is similar to the trepidation and fear here of who will the next creative team be and will they get it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that's kind of my, because we've seen over the years some writers of the Green Lantern universe that get it and some that don't.
Right.
You know, I think back to the Charles Soule writing Red Lanterns, which is really good, versus the initial run of Red Lanterns.
Joshua Hale Fialkov, I believe was his name.
Something like that. Yeah. So there are just, there's always a trade-off there. There's always a risk there. Hopefully we'll get someone new and exciting in there to take over the reins, and we'll see where it goes from there. But I've enjoyed his run, and I hope you all have enjoyed this abbreviated edition of the Hard Traveling Fanboys, because that's about all we got for you, folks.
Mm-hmm.
Next week is a very big week, very very big week.
Tentatively, we'll have to discuss that off air. May or may not be a very big week.
Next week is a week.
Yes, it is. That has the potential to one day develop into a week that could be considered character big. But that's, you know, again, another discussion for another time.
It has characteristics not unlike being the potential to be that.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll get to that at another time. But nonetheless, we have a lot of great things on your way. Big things, huge things, the best things coming your way. And again, we want to thank our colleagues for their very kind words last week. We want to encourage you to listen to all of their great podcasts. Seller's Points. Russell's got Big Bad Brad joining him on the telecast this week. Last week by the time you're listening to this. You should listen to Geek and Sassy. They've had the Sassy Awards. They've had an interview with Bobbert the Clown. They've got all kinds of cool stuff going on in their universe, the Geek and Sassy universe, and they are keeping it Gucci every single week, or every single episode, I should say. And on top of that, you've got Todd Weber's Conversation,
kind of,
and that's always a tremendous show. Talking Pop, the hottest new sensation to sweep the Place to Be Nation landscape.
And it's not
Tim and Jenny.
It's not going to be any time. It's not imminent. The release is not imminent. But there is another. There is a new podcast in the works that will just continue to add to the veritable heaven of podcasts, of comics podcasts on the Pop feed that might feature certain individuals who you are familiar with from this show.
That's true. And lest we forget, the long promised Comics on Wrestling podcast.
That is the development hell of Place to Be Nation Pop, where I don't know that it's ever going to happen, Greg.
It's got to happen. And that reminds me, Nick, of a very important thing that that I am in no way stalling for time to pull up something to help me with right now. And that is the fact that I'm putting a minute on the clock because it's time for the Wrestling Minute. The hot story this week, Nick, is the return of Daniel Bryan on SmackDown. He's been cleared by doctors. He came out. He cut a great promo.
Yep.
And at the end of the show, he just looked like dynamite in his segment with Kevin Owens and Sami Zayn.
Yeah, you know, I have been a little bit out of the loop on the wrestling, so I've got lots of stuff to catch up on. I've got deletions to enjoy. I've got Daniel Bryan promos to enjoy. I got a lot of work to do over the next few days to try and get back caught up. But I did just see a piece of news that I think you'll enjoy, Greg. On the call for the greatest Royal Rumble live from Saudi Arabia, good old JR, Jim Ross.
Yes! Yes! I hope that he has to announce a lot of complicated Saudi Arabian politician names during the show.
He said I could call him Farouk.
Farouk Assad is one hell of a hand, quite frankly.
Quite frankly.
But again, it's not for me to say. Dan Hodge was a better hand. Also, Zack Sabre Jr. wins the New Japan Cup. Looking forward to his fight with Okada.
Yes, absolutely. Should be a fantastic main event for Genesis in Sakura.
Yes, and that's been the Wrestling Minute. The minute's up. The Wrestling Minute, folks. Stay tuned next week to hear what other musings and observations we may have in 60 seconds or less. With all that being said, please give us some feedback. Twitter, Facebook, email, you know the drill. Send a carrier pigeon. We'll shoot it down and then pick it up and look at what message you tied to it. We'll do whatever we can. In the meantime, please go out there, read a comic, watch a show, do better than us, and we'll be back next week. Same HTF time, same HTF channel. Place to be Nation Pop.
Keep all that money for evidence. I said, well, son, when you hot, you hot.
When you're hot, you're hot. When you're not, you're not.
You can split it all down at City Hall. I say, yeah, when you're hot, you're hot. In the court, I couldn't believe my eyes. The judge was a fishing buddy that I recognized. I said, hey, judge, old buddy, old pal, I'll pay you that $100 if you get me out of this spot. So he gave my friends a little fine to pay. He turned around and grinned at me and said, 90 days, Jerry, when you were hot, you were hot. And I said, thanks a lot.
When you're hot, you're hot. When you're not, you're not.
He let my friends go.